Hi, everybody. Welcome to our monthly mind share for November. I can't believe it's already November, that 2018 is almost over. I'm here with Ellen. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Margaret. Hi, everybody. Happy November.
Yes. Hope y'all had some fun Halloweening last week. Ellen, why don't we start with what you're the most excited about?
Darn it, I always forget we're going to do this. Well, I guess I'm pretty excited that I'm going to get a massage tomorrow afternoon because I threw my back out this weekend and I can't really move. I'm doing a lot of standing. So right now, that's all I can think about. I'm very excited. Aww.
I hope that fixes things.
Me too. Thank you.
So what I'm most excited about is I'm headed to LA tomorrow for the rest of the week. And I used to live there and now I live in Portland, Oregon, and we are officially entering into cold and rainy season. So I'm super excited that not only do I get to go see a lot of my clients in person, which I don't normally get the luxury of doing, but I'm also very excited for some warm weather, let's be honest. So so I'm going to go get me some sunshine. So that's what I'm doing. So tonight we've got some great questions. We're going to go through, first of all, the questions that you guys posted on the forum. And then, of course, as always, we'll leave room for some live questions at the end. So just a quick reminder to the best way to ask questions as we go through this is to do it through the Q&A as opposed to the chat. The chat is a little bit hard to monitor and follow and make sure that we've answered things so things get lost there. So please ask those questions through that Q&A feature. So let's just dive right on in. So, Mary Jane has the first question. What would you recommend for a four-year-old girl whose GI map shows no dysbiotic bacterial overgrowth, three high normal bacteria, the Bacteroides, Escherichia, and Enterobacter, present but normal Epstein-Barr virus, but very high calprotectin at 282. Nothing else is out of range. So, Mary Jane, you didn't mention if you have done an MRT on this little one, but that would absolutely be the place to be looking for. If her inflammation is escalated like that, you will need to know why. And clearly there aren't any overt pathogens here. You know, a present but normal Epstein-Barr virus isn't something that would cause that calprotectin to jump up. High normal bacteria, those aren't really things that you would be worrying about nearly as much as the other opportunistic bacteria that you'd worry about in other pathogens. So really, what you'd want to be looking at here are food sensitivities and doing some basic gut healing protocol. So number one, do that MRT if you haven't done so already. In terms of the kinds of supports that you could use for this little one, you definitely, you didn't share what her elastase marker was. But if it is food sensitivities, you could definitely do something like the Vitalzymes chewables, which are a great chewable enzyme product designed specifically for kids. They taste great. My kids love them. Assuming that they aren't contraindicated on the MRT in terms of the ingredient list. So that would be something you could do. That they are by Claire Labs. You can get them on Natural Partners. Make sure, of course, she's getting some really good probiotics. I would definitely add in some kind of gut healing support, and which one you use will definitely depend on the MRT results. But GI Revive, because it's really sweet with that stevia and peach flavored, if she tolerates those ingredients, that's a great one to use with kids. And then, of course, you want to be removing all the food irritants per the MRT. So something's irritating that gut lining and causing that inflammation. And if it's not a pathogen, then the next thing you have to look for food sensitivities. And I've done a lot of work with kids right from, months old up till teenagers, but a lot in this sort of young elementary school age. And a lot of them do have significant food sensitivities, and it can make a really, really big difference when you take those out. So you also didn't share what kind of symptoms she's having overall, like what caused you to actually do this GI map. So that might guide some other supplement recommendations, but those are some basic things that you can do for sure right there.
Kim asked a follow-up question to that awesome answer, which is she would want to know if it's possible to get four vials of blood from a four-year-old.
You bet. It's possible to get it from a three-month-old.
Now, isn't it they sure don't. They'll let you do one fewer vial if it's a kid.
Yeah, so the absolute minimum they need to be able to do this test, and they don't say this, they like to have more because it just gives them, more margin for error on their end. But the absolute minimum they need is actually two full vials. So if you're not able to get the four vials, then two full vials is sufficient. I did this on my daughter when she was, gosh, how old was she when we did that first test? I guess she was over a year. She was, you know, we did the full four with her. I've had others where we haven't been able to get even two vials, and that was not, they weren't able to do it. Now, the really nice thing about the folks at Oxford is that if for some reason you're not sure if it's enough or not, just send it in. And if it's not enough, they're not going to charge you for it. It's sort of no harm, no foul. The only thing is that you'd have paid for the draw fee, which you would have paid for anyway. So, you know, I would also say that something that's really important when you're working with little kids is finding a phlebotomist that is experienced with working with little kids. That makes just a huge difference. And I know it's already a bit of a challenge finding phlebotomists to do the MRT draw to begin with. But if you have some options, do a little homework and do some digging to see if you can find somebody who is really knows how to work with kids, because that can really make all the difference in the world. I know that there is one that we used to use when we were in LA. He was absolutely like the child whisperer. Like no kid had any issues with him at all. He was so good, and he was a mobile phlebotomist and very accustomed to working with kids. So he was fantastic. And then I've had experiences with other phlebotomists who are not as experienced working with kids, and it's just a totally different creature when you're working with a little one like that. So that would be another thing that you really want to consider there.
All right. So Colleen asked a question. She said, the Biocidin site. Also, I have to tell you, I recently went to a talk given by the inventor and CEO of the company, and it is Biocidin. So I kept saying Biocidin, and now we know it's Biocidin. The Biocidin site states that Biocidin can be used for eradicating parasites, bacteria, yeast, and also acts as a biofilm disruptor. In what situations can we use just this one supplement instead of 3 to 5 separate ones if someone has parasites, yeast, and dysbiotic flora? When would we definitely need to use a combination of supplements? So Colleen, you know, we want to try to combine supplements as much as possible for reasons of compliance and reasons of cost and, you know, just to not make things too onerous on our clients. And that's one of the reasons that we really like these combination products like Biocidin, for example, as opposed to you know, what one noters like paramicrocidin, which is great if you just have one thing to deal with. Biocidin certainly has a lot of very impressive research available that's showing that it works on all forms of pathogens. And it does definitely contain herbs that act as biofilm disruptors through interrupting the quorum sensing. We haven't turned to it yet to use with our clients for straight up parasites because our parasite protocol triad of the GI Microbex, the APMAG, and the Interface Plus just works so darn well that it's hard for us to be motivated to try something else. But certainly, you know, you do get these people who have really complex presentations and lots of different multiple pathogens. And one thing that you could do would be to try the Biocidin protocol and then see what remains on retest, you know, and let us know what you find out. Because if you decide to go that way, you know, we would love to know what kind of results you get with parasites. We've just been hesitant to make the turn away from a protocol that we know works really well. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, one of the things that I do in this scenario is if there are, it kind of depends on what combination of pathogens you're seeing. So if I found just a combination of yeast and dysbiotic flora, then I would be comfortable with using probably just the Biocidin. If I was seeing tons of both of those, I might just like want to add one more thing in just because I tend to lean on the overkill just to get it done rather than any time I've been tentative on protocols with these pathogens, they just, it just ends up extending the whole situation, which none of us want.
Absolutely.
Whenever I see a parasite, what I would do here is I would do exactly, you know, we love our parasite protocol triad exactly, as Alan says so much, what I've done, and I've had a bunch of these lately where I've had parasites plus a whole bunch of other things on the GI map. And so I've done the parasite protocol and then added Biocidin in because of this complex and kind of overarching, you know, does everything thing. So because, you know, we're still, you know, kind of at the beginning stages of getting retest results back from our clients on the GI map. Plus also we started using some of these products that are newer to us at around the same time. We don't have enough sort of anecdotal evidence at this point yet to be able to say one way or the other, but this is very much the approach we're using. And for the reasons exactly as Alan says, because there's so much great research on this, we feel really confident and comfortable with that Biocidin in particular.
Yeah, and it's such an easy one to add into a protocol that is full of pills because of the liquid. I mean, it tastes good. It's so easy. It's an easy one to add on there.
Totally. Colleen asks, how long is too long with eradication supplements? Is there a point where using supplements that kill off bacteria will cause more harm than good? Since the supplements get rid of the good as well as the bad, will keeping clients on these for a prolonged period of time throw off their microbiome? What's the longest you should keep clients on the eradicating supplements? Is it a good idea to continue to switch up the eradicating supplements or follow the same protocol for over 4 months? Is there a point where you decide to just focus on pumping in the good bacteria and let the body balance itself out? I went to a seminar with Dr. Natasha Campbell-McBride where she stressed not overkilling and the fact that the body can balance itself out when given the right resources. It really stuck with me. I'd like to understand how we know where that stopping point is in regards to supplementing. So I've got a lot of things to say to this. One, I do want to say just a comment to the Dr. Natasha Campbell-McBride. I've gone through her GAPS training, and there's a lot of things that are really powerful in that. I know that she's very, she really kind of approaches things from like supporting the good and letting that kind of push out the bad. And quite honestly, we haven't seen that work very well. That doesn't mean though that you want to overkill. So that's a really, really important and a very valid point. So we always do our protocols in these 3 month sprints. So you're not going to have a client on an antimicrobial protocol really for longer than 3 months, because at that point they're going to be taking off the antimicrobials, giving it a bit of a rest, doing the retest. And then it's at that point, based on the retest results, where you want to, if things haven't fully resolved, you still see multiple pathogens and the client is still experiencing symptoms, you're going to make the choice at that point of whether another round of antimicrobials is warranted and whether you want to mix things up at that point. And it's hard to say, just sort of like a general rule for this, because it's going to be so much on a case-by-case basis, In some cases, if things are progressing really well and you just feel like, what you have been doing is really working, but you just need to kind of take it over the edge, you might stick with what you've been doing and have the client go back on it for a little bit. If what you've done has brought up a whole bunch of other things, which you don't see very often, but it does happen, you probably want to switch things up, because if you had biofilm disruptors and some other agents, and then when you did the retest, maybe the original things have been addressed, but a bunch of other things came up. That means that biofilm disruption kind of opened up these new layers, and what they were taking didn't do the trick. So you need to mix things up so that you find something that does do that trick and actually kill it off. But this is a really important point, that the antimicrobials, even though they're herbal, are really potent and they can be microbiome disrupting. So you definitely don't want to be overdoing it, even though they're not going to have the same negative impacts and fallout as you would have with full-on antibiotics or other medications. They're still not innocuous. Now, this is also one of the reasons why we always build probiotics and ideally some fermented foods into the protocols with our clients so that they can be replenishing as they're going through things. Now, another really important piece to this is that you might not get a perfect retest back, and you have to make the judgment call as a clinician working with the client to determine whether a whole other round of antimicrobials is warranted or not. I've certainly had situations with clients where they've had absolute complete symptom resolution and feel fantastic, and there's just a couple little things here and there that are still popping up. It's unlikely that I'm going to put them through an entirely new antimicrobial round just because of those couple little things. Now, if those things came back and they were still experiencing some symptoms, that's a completely different situation. Or if entirely new things came back, or the new things that came back were really quite elevated, there's just a lot of different factors to be taking into account here. All to say that you don't just, as we know, we don't just look at the test results. We have to take that into that bigger clinical picture of how the client is presenting overall from a symptom perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I just want to say I've not done any of Dr. Campbell McBride's trainings, but there are certainly other experts out there who are saying the same type of things. We had Kiran from the Megaspore people on, and he talks about that as well. Now, obviously they sell probiotics, so that does kind of go hand in hand, but there are other experts out there saying that as well. And I think this kind of comes back to what we were saying about in Colleen's question about using biocidin for parasites. It's like, could that work? It possibly could, but we have these protocols that we know work so well that none of us are willing to step away from the protocols that we know work to try to let the body balance itself out by giving lots and lots and lots of probiotics. So, you know, I think one thing that I think, the more education you do, the more you realize there is as much art as there is science in what we do. And everybody's going to have different approaches to how they do things. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there's right or wrong. It just means that we have some things that we know work. Okay. Kelly asks, I have a potential client who's very interested in the Genova NutriVal test and the GI Effects test as well. I've looked into both of these so I can be knowledgeable on both of them, and I've determined that the GI Map is a better test. I'm wondering, though, if there are other tests on Evexia that we can order and use in our nutrition practices, such as the NutriVal. I've never really understood if we're only allowed to order the test that we've been trained to use in restorative wellness, or if some others are also available to us. I see that this test is also available with Direct Labs. There's a Genova webinar for learning to use it in practice. Is this one that we can order, or are we limited to the ones that we've learned in class? So Kelly, you absolutely can order any test that's on Evexia. You have an account with them, and everything that's on there is open to you. I think the thing that you always want to ask yourself is there's really two main questions. The first is, do you know what to do with the results when you get them back? And you know, practically every test that we run, with a few exceptions, somebody could go on Direct Labs and order for themselves. But then what, right? They have the results and they don't know how to build a healing protocol around it. So that's the first piece of the question. And then the second piece is this test going to actually bring some real, you know, added value into the work that you're doing with your client? And nutrient evaluation tests are one that I would sort of think about in that category. They tend to be very expensive, these tests like the NutriVal, and there's other labs that have them as well. And we generally know when our clients come to us that they're going to be deficient in a variety of nutrients because their diets probably haven't been particularly great and their digestion is compromised. So certainly you could run that test, but to run that test on somebody at the beginning stage of your work with them before you've addressed diet or absorption or any of that is throwing $400, $500, $600, $700 down the toilet as far as I'm concerned. But you know, so the answer is yes, you can. And we just recommend that you choose wisely, basically.
It's these tests, a lot of them are really looking at the end result. They're looking at downstream effects. They're not looking for root cause. So they're very tempting, particularly for clients. And, you know, I mentioned this because you mentioned here that that it's a client that's really interested in it, and they are tempting because it looks like, ooh, here's a list of all the things you're deficient in, and here's like your perfect supplement profile to fix it all. And there's an allure to that, but that's not actually helping to heal anything or to get to the root cause. And so one of the reasons we don't use this particular test is because it's not addressing root causes, and we're all about root causes and not just coming up with a brand new supplement cocktail that's going to fill in the gaps. The question is, why are they deficient in these different nutrients? And is there a way to get them exactly as Ellen says, like through digestion, all these kinds of pieces. So that's another piece of it. It is a little bit of a slippery slope when you have clients who come to you really wanting certain tests, because they're not necessarily thinking about it from the perspective that we bring. And that's one of the really valuable roles that you can play as a practitioner, is to help them understand the differences between these types of tests, what's actually going to help them heal and what's going to be sort of, you know, a few bells and whistles and gives some things that look really impressive but aren't actually going to really help them heal. Now, if you were getting into a client who was really like sort of, you've done everything and just some stubborn things aren't moving, then yeah, that would be a good time to see it. Like maybe there's just a really key nutrient that they need to substitute that you couldn't have figured out otherwise. I'm not saying there's no role for these tests. I'm just saying, be careful, exactly as Ellen says. So Joey asks, how are you determining when to use a biofilm disruptor with the GI map? It doesn't seem as clear cut as the doctor's data test. Yeah. And I would appreciate hearing how you make the call with this test. So it's actually fairly similar as with the doctor's data comprehensive stool test, and with the exception really of the fungal overgrowth. That's the key place where it's a bit different. So if you see any kind of dysbiotic or opportunistic bacteria that's elevated, so high, and you're going to be doing antimicrobials, you're going to want to use the biofilm disruptor, just like we always have whenever we see any kind of elevations in those dysbiotic bacteria. If you see parasites, you're definitely going to use the biofilm disruptor. And the place where there's a bit of a question is with fungal overgrowth. And this is going to be a place where you need to use your clinical judgment. you know, you could use it or not. You could base this on the severity of the client's symptoms. You want to take into consideration the overall protocol that you have the client on. It can't hurt to use it when you see fungal overgrowth. So it's, you know, if it particularly, and this is another sort of plug for the combo protocol, or combo products such as Biocidin, you know, if you were going to use something like that, which has tested really well for fungal overgrowth, it also has that biofilm disruptor in there. It's a one and done kind of deal in terms of the supplementation. So that might be the approach. Of course, it's going to depend on the overall picture of that client profile. But that is basically, you know, that's basically how we use it based on GI map results. Okay, Jolene has a question. I have a 36-year-old male client with his main complaint being eczema and recurring ear infections after lots of antibiotic use. I ordered the comprehensive stool analysis test and found gut dysbiosis, no growth for 3 beneficial flora, and a whole bunch of imbalanced or dysbiotic flora and moderate yeast overgrowth. I used the restorative wellness protocol for 4 months. Each time we'd stop the protocol, his ear infections would come back, including when we went off to retest using the GI map. The results of the retest showed all his markers that previously were out of range are now in range, even though they were still present. So that's, to define this, so they're not, so they're showing, but they're in black. So they're within what is considered to be the lab range, but they're definitely still in evidence, not elevated. The markers that came back as elevated were beta-glucuronidase, and it's quite elevated at 3,268, steatocrit, calprotectin, and SIGA. So we're seeing a lot of these functional markers quite elevated. My question is with the beta-glucuronidase. I know that toxins bind to bile and carry it out. With his steatocrit being high, but his elastase 1 within range, my thought process is, can the beta-glucuronidase be high because he's not making enough bile to carry out the toxins and excess hormones, or is his liver working too hard that it's not making bile efficiently? He also has a terrible time with die-off when he first started the protocol. Could these toxins that were being released from the yeast, et cetera, have been recirculated back into his system? Am I thinking this through correctly? Also, in your healing solutions protocol, you don't list using calcium deglucurate. Is there a reason for that? I know it may be a band-aid till we get his liver, gallbladder, and gut flora better supported, but is there a reason why I should not recommend it to him? I will also support him with beta TCP, milk thistle for his liver, and mega IgG 2000 for his immune system, and continue to work on his gut flora. He feels better, but the ear infections and eczema are still present, just not as pronounced. He was on the Candida diet protocol and was very faithful. I'm ordering him a food sensitivity test. He was not able to financially at the beginning, but now he feels he needs to due to his inflammation and the high SIGA. Is there something else I should be doing with this elevated beta-glucuronidase? Do I continue to support the gut and liver and retest to see if it comes down into range? Okay, this is a huge question. Lots of different aspects here to address. I'm going to do my very best on this. Jolene, are you live with us? I'm not sure if you're on live. Oh, whoops. Sorry. Anne, I just accidentally clicked on you. Sorry. How do I undo that? Sorry, there we go. Okay, sorry.
Jolene is here.
Jolene, you're here. So if you have things to add to this as I go through, that would be great. So, and if I haven't answered all of your questions. So, okay, let's just start at the beginning. So first question, well, first of all, I just want to say, it sounds like you didn't run the MRC with him the first time. And this is a really, really good example of why it's so important to do both of these tests at the same time. We'll never know, because we can't go back and do both of these tests, if he would have had full resolution had he done these two tests. But I will say that every time I've had results, or not every time, every time I haven't done the MRT with the gut healing, I've had results like this where things just haven't fully resolved. I have occasionally had those kinds of things as well when I do the MRT with it, but universally every time I haven't done the MRT, which has not, you know, granted been that many times because I learned this pretty early on and pretty quickly, I just learned that the absolute best chances of healing are when you do the two together. So you definitely have a really great firsthand story now and that firsthand experience. So you will be that much more insistent with future clients that it will, in the long run, save them a lot of money and time if they're able to do both of these tests together. We don't know is the reality of whether that would make a big difference, but we see, you know, the elevated calprotectin, the elevated SIGA, you know, we still see a lot of dysfunction there. That could very well be because there's still inflammatory foods in his system, and so full gut healing has not been achieved. Now, with that elevated beta-glucuronidase, a few questions here. You know, one question would be, if have you ever done blood work on him? Because I'd just be curious to see if some of those liver enzymes or gallbladder markers are doing anything funky to kind of show that there's impaired detoxification ability there. I would wonder about his stools because of that steatocrit. So is he constipated at all? You know, you've made these connections here between the liver working too hard, not making bile efficiently. I don't know that that's going to cause necessarily directly an elevation in the beta-glucuronidase. They're related, but not. It doesn't necessarily happen sort of like if A, then B, and that kind of logical progression. The elevations in the beta-glucuronidase are more the end result of dysbiosis in the gut, which you have mostly resolved. It's very interesting that these symptoms come back every time he goes off the antimicrobials specifically, right? Like he seems to be doing quite well when he's still on the antimicrobials. He does not do as well as soon as you go off them, which really confirms the fact that an element of this for him is that there is still something going on in that gut, even if it's not showing. Now, I'd be interested to see, you know, how many of those things are in evidence. You know, if he has a lot of opportunistic bacteria that are appearing and they're not elevated, but there's a lot of them and he's still having these symptoms, this actually might be one of those situations that actually warrants another round of antimicrobials. You know, there's certainly a school of thought if you have a lot of different things, even if they're not elevated, but there's multiple things quite in excess plus continued symptoms, you might actually want to address it from that that dysbiotic bacteria perspective. Now, you asked about the calcium deglucurate, and we do actually have that listed now in the healing solutions. That was an omission, and it has been added, I think, actually just last week or the week before. It's been added fairly recently. So if you go back onto the classroom site and you download the most recent version of the healing solutions, then you will see it there. So basically the one we use is from Designs for Health. The dose is 2 a day and to do that with meals. So that can absolutely help support that detoxification process while you're doing that deeper work. Now, there's definitely implications here in terms of the detoxification process as well. So you want to be thinking about supporting detoxification pathways, which you are with the milk thistle. Definitely get him on some gallbladder support. I don't know if that was part of his original protocol, but when we see that steatocrit elevated, that's certainly a piece of things. You know, something that you might want to consider is that if he's still having lots of die-off types of responses, you might want to add in a binding agent, something like a GI detox, which will help to bind to those toxins as he's eliminating them and help pull this out. So the combination of the calcium deglucurate and something like a GI detox, if the calcium deglucurate is not enough and these other pieces of the puzzle that you're bringing in are not enough, then adding in something that's extra to kind of help bind to and pull out those toxins could be really helpful. And a product like GI detox, or if he's sensitive to any of the ingredients in that, you know, like apple, it's got apple pectin in it, just as an example, you know, even just straight up activated charcoal can be a great solution for that as well. Now, I do want to mention that you mentioned this ear piece, and I don't know if it's ear pain or if it's an actual diagnosed ear infection, but just one thing is that ear pain is something that is very common with Epstein-Barr virus. So if you did blood work on him and you saw the pattern for a chronic virus, then he might want to do some testing for that as well. But that's just sort of a footnote sideline. I think you've got other things to work on here that will probably give you, you've got a lot to deal with here. I don't think you necessarily need to run out and do blood work if you haven't done so already. I'm more mentioning that in case you do have blood work on him and you can kind of take a look and see if it gives you any additional clues. So I think that I have answered all of your questions there. I hope I have. And if there are additional ones, Natalie asks, wouldn't an active Epstein-Barr virus show up on the GI map? Not always.
Well, it would, but it doesn't mean he has an active Epstein-Barr virus. He could have a chronic Epstein-Barr virus.
Yes.
It's only a very recent active infection that shows up on GI map.
Yeah, and it's active in the acute phase, not the chronic phase.
Good job. Okay. There were a couple of follow-up comments that folks made that I just wanted to talk about. This was referring back to this concept of, can you just support the good and let the bodies try to take care of the bad guys if you've done protocol after protocol? And Anne points out, thank you, Anne, that in a recent webinar, she heard Kiran from Megaspore mention that if a person has parasites, an antimicrobial would be needed to eradicate the parasite in addition to adding appropriate probiotics to restore the microbiome. So that in that situation, Kiran thinks the way we do. And when we were talking about the NutriVal test or any of these other sort of nutrient tests, Kim said, would knowing the nutrients you are deficient in assist with the root cause of healing, for example, such as needing zinc to improve HCL production? Maybe. Is a good way to put it. You know, most likely, again, at the beginning, our folks have so much other basic stuff going on. You know, if you've ever heard the expression, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras, right? So we're starting with the really obvious stuff, the compromised digestion, the gut pathogens, all of that. And like Margaret said, if you get really down the road with this person and you've done all the right things and it's just not getting somewhere, then sure, you might look for that. When it comes to something like zinc for hydrochloric acid, most of these nutrient tests are serum tests, and that's really not a good way to test full body sufficiency for things like zinc and some other minerals. You have to actually test red blood cells, which is way more expensive to do. So, you know, and it's not always going to give you the most bang for your buck when you're really looking for a needle in a haystack at that point.
Right. Totally. So those are all of our questions from the forum. I see Anne has a question here. And so just to open it up for the rest of you, if you have other questions you want us to answer here live, we can do so now. So I'll start with Anne's. She says, I have a client that has been adamant about taking hydrochloric acid to tolerance and zinc as her zinc levels on her blood chemistry showed low. She has been taking zinc for a long time and still cannot raise the levels. What should I do next? So, Anne, I'm assuming when you say zinc levels on her blood chemistry, you're thinking of the alkaline phosphatase, which is more of a sort of downstream effect than it is, or showing the impacts of zinc depletion as opposed to a straight up marker of zinc deficiency. Just want to make that clarification since Ellen was just talking about zinc on a blood panel. This is a different marker. So assuming that that's what you're talking about, Anne. A couple of things. So she's been taking her hydrochloric acid and zinc to tolerance, which is great. One thing, you want to make sure she's taking the right zinc. So not all zinc, you know, there's definitely the reason why we support the products that we do or recommend the products that we do in our Healing Solutions is that these are the ones we've had the best results with. And quite honestly, and I know this is frustrating because not everyone has access to it, but the zinc liver chelate from Standard Process is probably the best one that we've seen in terms of impacts. I know that historically I've worked with some like the S enzyme or Z enzyme from Forte from Biotics and had okay results, but not quite as good as the zinc liver chelate. So one of the first things you could try is changing up the type of support to see if it's just that the product is not enough, or you can also kind of superdose for one bottle and see if that moves the needle at all. The other thing that, you know, when you say a long time, I'm not quite sure how long you mean, but if it has been, you know, many months, then definitely have her take a little break on that. And you want to be keeping an eye peeled for some symptoms of things like, because so zinc, the relationship that zinc has is with copper. So you want to make sure you're not necessarily driving down those copper levels. You could be watching for some of the sort of basic signs and symptoms of copper deficiency. And so things, you know, you can look these up, but certain things like fatigue and weakness, someone who's getting sick all of the time, although that's interesting because that also suggests a zinc deficiency. I mean, honestly, looking at it from symptom perspective isn't like the best way to do this. You can Google what those symptoms are so you can see what the symptoms of copper deficiency are, but that would be one of the things that you'd be thinking about. And respond here, yes, it's the alkaline phosphatase marker she's looking at. She's been taking zinc liver chelate. She's been taking it for 4 months. Well, I will say that I've had clients who have been taking it for that, and it's taken at least that, if not longer, to get those levels up. If you haven't, if it's really not budging and it's both the hydrochloric acid and the zinc and the alkaline phosphatase numbers that are just not moving, like her, she's not able to bring down her hydrochloric acid at all, and the zinc isn't working, or that the alkaline phosphatase isn't increasing, you could increase the dose to 2 zinc liver chelate per meal. From one, a normal dose is 1 zinc, 1 per meal. You could increase that to 2 per meal for one bottle, and then, you know, have her you could do the taste test, or you could retest that one marker on blood work, that just to see if that's moving things.
I just wanted to add, there was a recent, Chris Masterjohn did a little thing on zinc recently. Somebody nicely posted it in the Restorative Wellness page. And he says that your body can only absorb X number of milligrams at a time. And it was a small amount. It was somewhere between 10 to 20 milligrams. I don't remember what it was. So his recommendation was, if you need to take 40, 50, 60 milligrams of zinc in a day, you need to break it up. And I immediately did that with my own zinc, broke it up into 40 milligrams a day.
That's a good thing. And that is exactly actually the reason why we have it broken up, like we normally do the per meal, so that it is distributed for that exact reason. And you could even go further. That's another way to do it. Another thing to think about is think about the cofactors in zinc absorption. And so yes, hydrochloric acid is one. What are some of the things, like, is she someone who is very, very much in sympathetic mode when she is eating? Is this something that she can like work on, like really kind of bringing herself more into that relaxed and parasympathetic state so that she's actually accessing the zinc better? And also I would double up when, and also have her eating more zinc rich foods as well, because sometimes the body is just way better at able at absorbing it from food than it is from a supplement. So, you know, weekly dose of oysters, you know, I know that's not everyone's cup of tea, but that kind of thing would be a great adjunct as well.
Pumpkin seeds, right? And the question of, is there, you know, potentially something else going on that drives that alkaline phosphatase down? I would have to go pull out my trusty blood chem binder, but I know there are other things too.
Totally. That's a really good point. Vitamin C is actually one of those things that you might be playing with as well.
Okay. Great. Jolene just had a little follow-up here. She said, thanks for going over my question. Interesting stuff. He had a very bad bout of Epstein-Barr as a teenager.
Interesting.
I do not have blood work for him. So, you know, very possible that he is in a chronic Epstein-Barr situation. You say, I think his ear problems are more pain and lots of flaky skin that he can pull out of his ear, which I'm thinking is part of his eczema. Food sensitivities, right?
Got it.
That MRT. And Jolene says his doctor keeps giving him antibiotics for the eczema and what's going on in his ear. So it could be one step forward, three steps back with his gut.
Totally.
You know,
it really sounds it.
You and the doctor being at cross purposes here.
And you really want to have a good conversation with him about, like, kind of picking an approach and going with it. Because every time he does those antibiotics, he really is setting himself back and basically disrupting all of the good work that you two are doing together. So it is one of those situations of just being really real with the implications of those things and not trying to, like, definitely not stepping outside of your scope of practice. There's certainly a way to have this conversation that does stay firmly within your scope of practice. And it's about educating him and not saying, look, I'm never going to be the one to tell you to not do antibiotics. So please don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. So be very explicit about what you are and aren't saying, and say, you know, it's completely out of my scope of practice to recommend whether you do or don't do this. We do need to just understand the implications. Every time you do the antibiotics, it is working completely to cross purposes with the work that we're doing here. And so it really doesn't make sense for you to be spending your money on and time and energy doing this healing work if we're continuing to add antibiotics to the mix, because it's exactly like Ellen said, it's 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, and it's not getting you where you need to go. So just be very clear that, you know, you're really not telling him what to do, but really wanting him to think through what makes the most sense for him in terms of his comfort zone and what's going to work for him, but that doing both is not working. It's not going to get him the results that he wants. And honestly, I think it'll make you feel a lot better too, if you're able to have that conversation, and then he can either opt in or opt out as best he sees fit. And then, you know, because you only want to work with him if he's going to get results, right? And he's not going to get results if he keeps doing antibiotics. So, gosh, those food sensitivities, man, that's going to make a huge difference if he gets those pieces out, if he's got all this eczema as well. So, that's.
All right. Good stuff. Okay, Natalie, I'm having a few clients lately that are so incredibly sensitive to everything that they can't even tolerate anything in the GI healing protocols because they react to everything. I'm having to do very gentle adrenal healing with a couple of these clients for a couple of months, and I'm finding that they're starting to feel better and coming back to life very slowly with this. And then we've started very slowly introducing some of the GI healing agents like L-glutamine. Do you guys experience this with very symptomatic clients where they are so depleted and hyperreactive that they simply cannot heal until we get some adrenal healing in? Just lots of vitamin C, pantothenic acid, etc. And then Natalie says, I worry about getting too far out from the MRT and GI testing by the time we can get to it. So, I mean, certainly, Natalie, this happens. Thankfully, it doesn't happen super often, but it does happen. And there's a few things to think about. I think you're on the right track. Sometimes these people are just literally at the end of their metabolic rope, and you do have to do some very nurturing, healing, supportive work to bring that HPA axis back online. Remember, the brain controls the gut too, right? So, you know, if you're really needing to deal with basic inflammation with things like fish oil, if they can even tolerate that, or just a lot of salmon, and the gentle adrenal healing, that's completely reasonable. Glutamine, yes, you know, someone always is going to ask the question about, well, isn't glutamine poorly tolerated by some people? Yeah, it is, but it's also very well tolerated by most people. So that's a great, very gentle choice when you do want to start the gut healing. It's okay to have to go that slowly. I know it can be frustrating for both you and the client, particularly if you've done a GI map and you've seen, you know, a whole bunch of things wrong in there that really do need to be dealt with directly. As far as you're concerned about getting too far out from the MRT and the GI map, you know, as soon as you start glutamine, if they're tolerating that, then you can start your MRT food elimination, right? Because that's the two pieces that go hand in hand, is the healing of the gut lining and the removing of the foods. Certainly, if there are foods that they know that they react to, or that perhaps came back, you know, sky high reds, there's no danger in telling them to go ahead and get those out of their diet, because it's probably just not doing them any favors until they're ready to start working on the glutamine. As far as worrying about being too far off from the GI map, those results are really not going to change, right? You know, if you found pathogens in there, they're still going to be there 3 months from now, 6 months from now, whenever it is that the person's ready to really dive into that type of healing. So while it's frustrating, I think you're taking the right approach.
Yeah, I would agree. And luckily it doesn't happen too often. You might just be getting a big rash of these. Sometimes you find that these issues come in these clusters, you know?
And the one other thing I'll add to that, and it's complicated though, is that sometimes these people who just react hardcore to everything, it's their detoxification pathways are so incredibly shut down that they just can't handle anything, including their own toxins. Now, the problem is you can't start detoxing these people, right? So you can start talking to them about the most gentle type of detoxification things that you know of, whether it's gentle sweating, whether it's dry brushing, rebounding, you know, the really, really gentle type of things, to start trying to get their system to be able to mobilize and handle a little bit of this more. It's pretty complicated for sure.
Yeah. Another thing that you can try in that same kind of vein is starting very gently with a little bit of a binding agent. So something like a GI detox, just one in the evening before bed, just something to help like grab onto things. If it is exactly what Ellen's talking about, just something to like grab onto and pull out the toxins that their body is already getting rid of. Sometimes not the best option for somebody who is constipated, but if you have somebody who is not and who's just, as you said, super, super sensitive, and you suspect that it's a detox pathway thing, then that is something that you can do. It's just sort of like dipping your toes into it, get some of that stuff out, and then you can bring some of the other agents in. Another thing to do is just to tippy toe into the functional supports before other pieces. That's sort of the next place to start. But yeah, some of these clients can be super complicated, and it's you know, it's really honing your skills to be able to customize and adapt, which is exactly what we have to do. Okay. Any other questions?
Are there any nutrients you use in a topical form? That's Natalie asking that as a follow-up.
Topical. You know, we played for a little while with these patches that we didn't get good results with.
I mean, magnesium for sure.
That's a good one.
Yeah. The other topical thing that we use a lot is the Adrenal Calm Cream from Apex, which is topical phosphatidylserine.
Also have the superoxide, or the what's it called? The
superoxycell, which is a glutathione cream. Yeah. Which can be a very gentle way to start to give somebody some glutathione support.
And that AdrenaCalm is a really nice way for to start doing some gentle HPA access support as well.
I don't think I use anything else topical.
No, me neither.
I will say Biocidin has a throat spray. I know that's not topical, but you don't swallow it. Amazing. No. That stuff is amazing. Think you're coming down with a cold, start spraying that a few times a day, gone.
Yeah, no, I... Right here, I live. Not that I've needed it. I've only used it once, but I was so impressed that I literally keep it right here just in case something starts to creep in. Yeah. And I will take it with me traveling. I'm putting it in my recommendations for like sort of natural first aid for all clients to just like keep that on hand because it is really good.
Yeah, I was really impressed with that.
Any other questions? We have a few more minutes here.
If you haven't yet, I just want to really encourage everyone to find the time to go through the new level one modules because there are so many pearls of information in there. You know, not only did we revise the healing solutions and revise a lot of the information that we're teaching, there's so much new stuff that we've added as well. Even some, you know, sort of business and organizational type of tools to really help you in your work with your clients. It's really good. There's just a lot of really, really, really good stuff in there. So very much encourage that.
Excellent. While we're waiting to see if there's any other clients or clients with any other questions, Ellen, could you give us a little update on what is coming up next?
Yeah. So our monthly mindshare this month is in the last week because otherwise it would have been the day before Thanksgiving. So it's November 28th and it's me doing a deep dive into things around the healing priorities of the body. I'm going to give you two case studies where you can learn from my mistakes when I did not work through the healing priorities of the body and what I learned. And I think you'll find it pretty interesting if I do say so myself. In December, we have, of course, our monthly Q&A on the 3rd and then on the 19th.
It's actually not on the 3rd. We moved that to the 10th and we might need to update the calendar on the website because it's Anne and myself doing that one and we are in a not reschedulable commitment all day the 3rd and the 4th. So we are going to move that actually to Monday the 10th.
Awesome. And then on the 19th, it's going to be a business topic and it's going to be Anne talking about topics of leadership and influence.
Excellent.
Which is pretty great.
Some great stuff coming out. Well, lucky, it looks like you guys don't have any more questions and we're all in the interest of saving everyone some time. So why don't we say goodnight. Thank you so much for your great questions. And we will see you here in a month, in a bit. Wonderful Thanksgiving and a wonderful holiday season beginning.
Absolutely. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.
Thanks, Ellen. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.